This land for the appellants, sovereign immunity issues, this penalty for the appellants, jurisdiction and standing, Mr. Parker for the appellate.
Morning, counsel. Please proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honor, and I'm Carolyn Lam on behalf of the appellants. We have divided the argument, and Ms. Kalanaki will address the appealability and the without prejudice denomination and standing. I'm going to the central issue in our view. First, there is no subject matter jurisdiction against the foreign state, here Russia, decided in this case under 1605A3. We appear for the appellants, not the Russian Federation. They are not in this part of the proceeding, but it's our appellant's assets that Chabad seeks to take to pay for over $200 million in fines that the district court has imposed against the Russian Federation as a result of their alleged defiance of an extraterritorial injunction to return some allegedly expropriated materials that are in Moscow. There's no question on these basic facts. The materials are not here in the United States. There's no allegation vis-a-vis the foreign sovereign that in fact there's any commercial use of those materials.
Suppose I agree with you that after our court's decision in the Seppel, that your view about the amenability of the Russian sovereign is set forth for going forward. So the question here is, what do we do about the fact that there was a lot of stuff that happened in this case before all that, including the original decision from our panel way back?
The Chabad one.
Yeah, Chabad one.
Shall we call it Chabad one?
And the question is, was there a finality attached to the jurisdictional presumptions that were in place at that time that would preclude the ability to revisit that now? Even if we thought that your understanding of the shuffle is right as a matter of what we understand.
No. A court always, and under one of your more recent decisions, in fact, you referenced this, the Y-Oak Tech versus Iraq. A court always has to re-examine its subject matter jurisdiction. And under the Sudan case, in fact, even if jurisdiction was previously raised, if a particular issue of jurisdiction was not, you can still consider that. So we don't agree that in terms of raising this issue now when our assets are about to be taken.
Let's suppose jurisdiction is found in a case involving a foreign sovereign. There's a judgment that's entered. Time for appealing that judgment has expired. That judgment has become final. And that sovereign, after the judgment has become final, collaterally attack it, so to speak, and say, well, really, that was wrong. Laws change. There's no subject matter jurisdiction over us after all.
The post-judgment challenge can be appropriate under certain circumstances. We don't say here the law has changed. We say it was never decided as to the foreign sovereign. Yes, you decided it, and we don't raise anything with respect to the library and the military archive, the other two Russian defendants. We raise that you never decided, nor did the district court decide the subject matter jurisdiction. And therefore, under Supreme Court precedent that we cite, as well as under your own circuit precedent, a judgment is void if it does not have subject matter jurisdiction. And this court, if you read his order that we are appealing from and his memorandum opinion that is incorporated in it, says, I'm not deciding anything else unless I have a direction from the circuit. And by the way, I would need an on-bank direction. But all of your cases, in fact, on the same issue, whether DeShepel, Simon, Phillips, they have gone for on-bank, been denied. Some have even petitioned for cert, been denied. No one disputes what the black letter language.
So I think that all goes to what the state of the law is now. I think still on this question that we've been asking you about, that gets to what do we do with the ground that's been plowed already in this case? Suppose you have a circumstance in which in the first instance, the sworn sovereign comes into the case, makes an appearance, files pleadings, and objects to jurisdiction. And there's a hearing on jurisdiction, and it goes really bad for the foreign sovereign. The foreign sovereign sees the writing on the wall and says, maybe even just says it, I see where this is going. We're going to withdraw. And so they just withdraw from the case. And then the case proceeds to judgment. There's a decision made that there's jurisdiction is to that foreign sovereign. And the judgment's entered. They withdraw. And then they come in later and file a collateral attack and say, actually, we'd like to actually challenge the jurisdiction. Can they do that?
It depends when. If there's been a default judgment entered so that it's then post-judgment, I think at the time that post-judgment, someone is trying to enforce a judgment that is devoid of jurisdiction and its issuance, it must be raised. It's a void judgment.
What happened was the first time around, the foreign sovereign came in and saw the writing on the wall. I see where this is going, but you know what? I got another chance. If I get out now, I can come back later after the default judgment's entered, and I might get a second crack at it, and I'm going to see if the law is better or I get a different forum or something.
Let me tell you what really happened in this case from the record, because I don't think it is as bad as the case you posited.
I'm not saying that it is, but I'm just wondering where your argument goes, because I guess that's the question. There is a principle of jurisdictional finality that kicks in some circumstances.
Does that
apply here? If you don't even think it applies in circumstances that I outlined, well, then that's one argument. But if you do think it would apply in that circumstance, but it doesn't apply here, then there's got to be some basis for us to say, notwithstanding the language and practical concepts that outlines the kind of choice that a foreign sovereign should make, why shouldn't we construe this circumstance to be having made one in which the choice was made, just like it was in the hypothetical that I read?
Right. I think we have to refer to the case that we've got before the court. And I think the facts here are compelling. Because, yes, there was participation by the Russian Federation at the outset. And then there was a denial of the motion to dismiss. They filed an answer. They sent a diplomatic note. And in the diplomatic note, they said, you know what? The property is in Russia. It's not in the United States. And they then, in filing a notice to withdraw, said, by the way, you can't get the property that's in Russia. We raise all the FSIA issues. The judge then, several years later, enters the default judgment. He does not consider the FSIA issue raised in the answer. He does not consider it as to the sovereign. He does not consider, in fact, what had been decided in Chabad 1. And if you look carefully at the decision in Chabad 1, the court only decided as to the library and as to the archive.
But the court did refuse to dismiss Russia or any of the agencies.
It did, but without any reasoning. It didn't consider the issues. And in fact, if you look at the words of the end of Chabad 1, the full sentence reads, "We reverse the district court's finding of Russian's immunity as to the library claims based on the events of."
So all that is right. I mean, and it's completely consistent with what our court said in the show.
That's right.
So all of this is right, but I don't see how that gets to squarely to whether, and I'm not saying I'm not saying I'm necessarily against you on this, I'm not saying necessarily for you, but it doesn't get to whether what had already happened in your case congealed given Russian appearance to an extent that precludes a collateral effect on that later.
And in our view, Your Honor, it does not. Because we say by failing, this is black letter law in the FSIA. You must have the property in the United States. By ignoring the black letter law, this wasn't some extraneous argument about subject matter jurisdiction. No one decided.
All that could be equally true in the hypothetical that I laid out. Suppose you have a district court that just, and I'm not saying this district court didn't, I'm just elaborating hypothetical. You could have one where the district court just ignored the black letter law. But then what happens is the foreign sovereign comes in and says, "I see where this is going. I made an appearance. I'm out of here. I'm going to try to get a second crack and have a better shot." And that seems like a tricky proposition to stop, even in that circumstance.
Well, even in that circumstance, I would say that under practical concepts, under Sudan, you can look post-judgment, of course. And even in that circumstance, this circuit has the obligation to examine its own jurisdiction and that of the district court. And there is no existing circuit decision on that, other than DeShevel, that goes on for two pages saying the issue was never decided.
Make sure my colleagues on
that. But I'll just take that just a little further. If you're looking at the DeShevel and it does criticize another panel, it's not overruling the panel. There's no iron footnote. There's no change in law by the Supreme Court. We haven't gone on that. So how do we deal with our own jurisprudence on that issue, even if it criticizes another panel?
Well, I think DeShevel's analysis had it right, because what the DeShevel court said is there isn't any intra-circuit or other split of any kind, and the district court judge recognizes this as well, because the issue wasn't decided. It wasn't briefed. It wasn't argued as to the foreign sovereign. And I read you the only sentence in there just conflates all of the defendants. So there's a non-decision, and I think the circuit law on that is good in the DeShevel. The Steel Co., the Citizens for a Better Environment, they say, you know, a drive-by jurisdictional determination really is not a jurisdictional determination. They look at it.
It's always known properly outside the U.S. throughout the legal proceedings.
Yes, that's the order, the default judgment order that was issued by the district judge at the outset in 2006 is an order of replevin to bring the documents to the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. He knew where those documents were.
All right. Thank you. We'll give you a little bit of time for rebuttal and some comments and additional questions. We'll hear from Dr. Now on the standing in the appellate position.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The court has appellate jurisdiction because appellants could appeal a denial of a motion without prejudice to obtain an order denying with prejudice. This is clear from the El Paso case in this circuit and others. Abada has never contested this reasoning, and nor could it. Here, the denial with prejudice is what was required given the uncurable jurisdictional defect, as Your Honor just referred to, that the property is in the Russian Federation. There's no allegation that it wouldn't be. If the property somehow came to the United States, this would be a completely different case. Because of that, no one disputes that the property is in Russia, and no allegation of additional facts would change the 1605A3 analysis. For that, dismissal with prejudice is required. And Chabad is wrong that we are appealing the opinion and not the order. Of course, the portion of the order says it's a denial without prejudice. We are appealing that. Moreover, the immunity issues that are raised in the appellant's briefs are necessarily included in the district court's order on notice under 1610C. The TIG case, the court had to assess its jurisdiction and immunity issues before getting to a post-judgment issue about notice.
I just want to be sure, because you mentioned reference to judicial finality. So clarify, are you looking at this under claim preclusion, issue preclusion, or lawful case, just so that whatever opinion we would write, we would discuss.
We believe that with respect to finality of the subject matter jurisdiction issue, the Bell Helicopter case controls here, that because there was a default judgment, the issue of subject matter jurisdiction has to be addressed. As Ms. Lamb explained, it was not final. There was no decision on Russia's immunity itself. This is very much like the Sudan v. Owens case. And to Your Honor's question about where does it end? We don't need to address that here because a motion to dismiss was made raising some jurisdictional issues. It is very common for a sovereign to raise some issues in the motion to dismiss and then come back later and have additional jurisdictional issues considered, whether that's a first a factual, facial challenge to the complaint and then later factual challenge. We don't have that here. The only ruling on Russia's subject matter jurisdiction issue, Russia's immunity, was in the default judgment context. And because of that, the practical concepts framework applies. There is no law of the case on this issue.
Shift gears on your for 1 second. So why do we have collateral order jurisdiction review authority over attachment immunity as opposed to jurisdictional immunity? Given that one of the predicates to collateral order review is that the issue is inclusively resolved.
The issue of within our brief, the two issues of attachment immunity, both are conclusively decided. All of the collateral order factors do apply. And the Seventh Circuit's decision in Rubin and the Fifth Circuit's decision in FG Hemisphere versus Congo are both instructive on this point. Attachment immunity issues are all can satisfy the collateral order doctrine. The main factor is conclusively decided because Judge Lambert was clear that he has no intent to revisit these issues that we have raised. He says that the only thing left to decide when Chabad removes to attach is the issue of veil piercing. So those two issues are conclusively decided. Further, they are completely separate from the merits of the veil piercing question or whether there is commercial property identified in the United States. And third, they are effectively unreviewable because the whole point of immunity, again, from the property shouldn't have to be attached in order for these issues to be considered. So the point of the immunity applies equally here. That is what the Seventh Circuit said in Rubin about attachment to the issues.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Robert Parker for Appellee Chabad. With me at counsel table is Steve Lieberman. If it please the court, I'd like to take the issues in the same order that opposing counsel took them. But I would like to start with a preliminary point that seems to have gotten lost, and that is Chabad 2, where in Chabad 2, this court ruled that these parties at appellant's table, that is 10X, that is the same party that's currently represented at appellant's table, doesn't have standing to challenge jurisdiction. They brought us Rule 60B challenge to jurisdiction. This court addressed that in Chabad 2, said they did not have standing. We raised that point in our brief. In their reply, 10X said, well, we didn't bring a case under Rule 60. We didn't bring this motion under Rule 60B. Well, then what basis do they have to challenge jurisdiction in the first place? What vehicle did they use to challenge jurisdiction, if not Rule 60B? If Russia were here today, Russia itself would have to use Rule 60B to challenge jurisdiction. So if they're not challenging, again, under Rule 60B, they have no standing. That's this court's decision in Chabad 2. And by their own admission, they have no basis for actually bringing that issue before the court. But let's assume...
Your argument that they have no standing with respect to the merits of the lawsuit, I mean, they filed a motion to quash, right? That's what we are hearing. So what does Rule 60B have to do with asserting a jurisdiction defense to the motion to quash?
Your Honor, in Chabad 2, they filed a motion to quash. Judge Lamberth denied that motion. Rather than file an appeal, direct appeal from that motion, they filed a motion challenging jurisdiction under Rule 60B. Judge Lamberth denied that motion again. It came up before this court in Chabad 2, and in Chabad 2, the court said, no, you do not have standing to challenge jurisdiction. They're not appealing from the motion to quash. That's long, the denial of the motion to quash, that's long past. They're not appealing from the denial of their Rule 60B motion. The court already held that they don't have standing to challenge jurisdiction under the Rule 60B motion. So my question is, what is their basis for challenging jurisdiction in this case? We don't know. They haven't said. But
I mean, they have to. What's the... They're subject to attack, right?
They are subject to attachment.
So what? How are they supposed to object to attachment?
Their objection to attachment is that, in fact, what you heard Ms. Lamb say earlier on, their objection to attachment is, we are not the alter ego of the Russian Federation. Okay. That's their objection to attachment. In order to attach their property, we have to show some connection between 10X and the Russian Federation. That's the issue that the district court in this case reserved and did not decide. Okay. 10X said, we're not the Russian Federation. We have nothing to, I mean, I'm being a little glib here, but we have nothing to do with the Russian Federation. We're not them. Okay. That's fine. They can challenge attachment on that issue. We disagree. But that's their position. They're not even taking the position that they're standing in Russia's shoes to challenge jurisdiction. They're saying, you didn't have jurisdiction to address the immunity of that guy over there, Russia. Therefore, you shouldn't be coming after us. But that issue has already been decided, and they don't have standing to challenge.
But if put aside jurisdictionality for a second, just for our reasons. If there were no jurisdiction over Russia, and that argument could be raised now, tenants would benefit from that, right?
I disagree with the premise, but yeah. I disagree with the premise in this respect. Let's go back to the basics. The basics are Judge Ginsburg's decision in Practical Concepts. And she set out a menu of options that a sovereign has when it is sued under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. She said, option one is you can appear, you can challenge jurisdiction. If you lose, you can take a direct appeal. That's it. You're done. Okay. Or the sovereign can say, I don't want to play this game. I'm going to sit out. And if these people can make out a claim and get a default judgment, then when they try to enforce it, I can jump in and attack and do a challenge jurisdiction there. Okay, those are the two menu items. Those are just the two items on the menu. Russia clearly chose option one on the menu. They appeared, they challenged jurisdiction, they lost, and they disappeared. Okay, they did not take option two. Okay, they did not. They did not default and not challenge jurisdiction and wait for post-judgment enforcement. Okay, so that's where the res judicata issue comes from. Okay, they had to follow one of those two options. If I may,
I don't disagree with you that the way the practical concepts formula is laid out in that opinion itself, it gives some force to your submission under finality. What about elements? So the Sudan case comes along later, and it actually cites practical concepts.
Correct.
And in Sudan, the facts are pretty parallel.
Correct.
You have a collateral challenge by a foreign sovereign, and it wasn't that the foreign sovereign was out the entire time in the first iteration.
If you look at Owens, what Sudan did was they took both options in parallel context. If you look at the very beginning of the opinion, what happened in Owens was Sudan, there was a lot of back and forth because they didn't pay their attorneys, but essentially, to put it short, Sudan defaulted when there was a default judgment entered against them. They jumped back into the case and they filed a direct appeal. Okay? That's option, effectively, that's option one of practical concepts. Okay, you can challenge jurisdiction in the main case on direct appeal. I guess either as a belts and suspenders kind of approach or to cover their bases. They also filed a motion with the district court to vacate the default judgment.
Right.
Okay, that's option two,
right,
under parallel concepts, right?
Right.
Okay. But there was no res judicata issue. Yes, they were allowed to do it, but there was no res judicata issue there because there had been no final appealed decision, okay, as there was here, establishing conclusively that the district court had jurisdiction. Okay.
So, if a party can exercise both options under practical concept, that's how you read Owens, then it's not an either or.
It isn't either or in the sense that what practical concepts, the first option is, if you challenge jurisdiction, take a direct appeal and lose, you're done. Owens took the direct appeal approach and the collateral approach at the same time. Russia just took option one. Russia just took option one, said, I'm challenging jurisdiction. I'm asserting, and this is very important, Your Honor, we may disagree on DeChapelle, but I think there's no disagreement that this court, the district court, and this court ruled that there was jurisdiction under FSIA with respect to these claims that Chabad had brought against these defendants. There may not have been discussion about Russia versus one of the other defendants, but certainly the courts decided that the district court had jurisdiction over Chabad's claims. That went to final judgment. The district court, you know, this court affirmed. That's practical concepts option one. And Russia.
So one aspect of practical concepts, at least something that gives it kind of intuitive force, is that you shouldn't have the same party coming back and having a second crack. And one of the distinctions here is that it's not the same part, because it was Russia and now we have Tennis.
And that's why they have the standing problem as well, because it's not Russia.
But if you take that one, even if we accept that, if you take that over to the practical concepts issue, then there is something a little bit odd or anomalous about applying practical concepts and the other cases on which it rested. Supreme Court case that cited, all of which involve the same party. And here we have somebody else.
It is anomalous, but it's not anomalous in the sense that there's sort of some concern that 10X won't get its day in court. 10X, when we go back to the district court, we will have to say to the district court that 10X property is subject to attachment because 10X is the alter ego in the Russian Federation. If we win on that point, that is, if 10X is in fact the alter ego of the Russian Federation, then why should they get a second bite at the apple? Because they're the alter ego of the party that limited in the first case. If the district court says they're not the alter ego of the Russian Federation, then the district court will say, then their property is not subject to attachment. So it's not like they're caught in a bind. It's like it's rather they want to have it both ways. They want to be treated as the Russian Federation for purposes of standing and res judicata, but they don't want to be treated as the Russian Federation for purposes of attachment. Because that's the issue we're going to have to decide when we go back to the district.
Do you think on the merits of the jurisdictional issue, if a case comes up tomorrow and it's filed in the first instance, and it involved these same kinds of facts where it's undisputed that under the way that the Chevron court looked at it, the foreign sovereign, there's no jurisdiction over the foreign sovereign in that the first prong of the commercial nexus part is not met. You'd have to go to the second prong of the commercial nexus prong in order to get jurisdiction of the foreign sovereign itself. Do you think it's actually an open issue in our court how that case would come out, or do you think that's now decided because of the judges?
I, Your Honor, respectfully, I think that Judge Lamberth is correct. I think there are two strains of thought on this court with respect to how to interpret 1605A3, the expropriation exception, that if you get to that issue, then it should be decided either by the court en banc or maybe even by, at some point, by a higher authority.
So what should a subsequent panel do? So if a panel gets that issue tomorrow, the panel can't say, the panel's got to decide the case before it. What would the panel do?
I think my advice to the panel would be to go back to the language of the statute and start from the beginning and apply the language.
And just ignore the fact that we have a decision, this Sheffield, that has come along and actually wrestled with Chabad 1 and outlined what it thinks is the lay of the land. The subsequent panel is shit.
I agree with you, Your Honor, that DeChapelle said that having looked at DeChapelle and Simon, in that, you know, Simon should prevail, even though DeChapelle was first. But I do agree also, as I said, with Judge Lamberth, that there are parallel and conflicting strains in this circuit's jurisprudence on this issue. May I take 2 minutes to talk about the attachment issue?
If you do it briefly.
Okay.
Unless my colleagues have questions on the rest of it.
Okay. And unless the court has questions, I'm not going to address the appellate jurisdiction issue.
That's fine.
Okay. So forgive me. I appreciate the accommodation, Your Honor. Just with respect to the attachment issue, the FSIA, at least to this extent, is very clear. The expropriation section is section 1605A3. It does not have a territorial restriction with respect to where the expropriated property is. That doesn't even make sense. If Russia expropriated a mine or a factory or a building, of course it wouldn't be in the United States. The expropriation takes place overseas. Okay. Once the court finds that the expropriation exception applies, that there's been an unlawful expropriation, again, there's no territorial limit in that provision with respect to where the property is. We then go and we look at 1606, which says once you found a violation, the defendant is subject, or the district court has the authority to issue the same remedies as it would as if the defendant were a private party, with the exception of punitive damages, which is not an issue. So the court, plainly the district court has authority to order the return of unlawfully stolen property. It's a replevin action. I think that our opponents ignore section 1606. The territorial restriction comes in after you have a judgment, when there's post-judgment activity.
It says you can attach property in satisfaction of your judgment, but that property has to be in the U.S. And we've identified Russian property in the U.S. Our position is that 10X's uranium is Russian property imported into the United States for commercial purposes. So therefore, there's no territorial restriction in the statute on the district court's authority to order the return of the unlawfully seized. There are other nuances to their argument, but given the time, I'll leave it there if the court has no further questions on any of these issues.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sam, ask for a minute to move on. I'll give you your minute.
A quick minute. You need FSIA jurisdiction for both jurisdiction under 1605A3 and for the attachment. And when this court is interpreting the scope of both, obviously you must look at the language of the statute, and under the Restatement Fourth and Foreign Relations 404, it's clear you don't make extraterritorial interpretations unless there's clear congressional intent. And this is the opposite case. There's clear statement that, in fact, it's property in the United States. The other point we heard, certainly a lot about the finality. You can't have finality if a court doesn't decide an issue. That's what happened here. The door was open.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Hagen, we'll give you the minute that you asked.
Your Honor, just 2 points. To clarify one aspect on the history, procedural history of the Owens case, there was no more finality as to the immunity of Russian Federation than there was as to Sudan. Sudan had moved to dismiss and also appealed that decision before it defaulted, and that decision was also appealed before it defaulted. That's the same situation here, although the decisions on immunity in our case didn't even deal with the Russian Federation. They actually dealt with the agencies and instrumentalities. So as Ms. Lamb said, there's even less of a determination in this case as to the immunity of the Russian Federation compared to the discussion in Owens pre-default of the immunity of Sudan. And then second, on the standing issue, I think that Your Honor had touched on this, that because 10X USA's assets are directly under attack in the motion to attach, which has been refiled in the district court. So again, 10X USA and these assets are being pursued by Chabad. They don't deny this. And it's black letter law that a party whose assets are being attacked has jurisdiction, standing, I'm sorry, to challenge the underlying subject matter jurisdiction of the court to enter the order that is being enforced against it. That's the Harrods v. Cuba case, Aurelius, in the Second Circuit, Carajo-Botas. We have a number of them. Thank you so much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take this case under submission.